Welcome to another episode of Thoughts of a Techno Wizard, Techno Shaman, Archaeo Futurist, and other cool stuff too. It is Monday, April 8th, 12:28 p.m. 2024. And it's just a probably a quick little pre-eclipse episode here. I just want to talk because I did want to be more consistent. So, you know, I've been falling off for a little bit, but mostly updates. It hasn't been, well, that's not quite true. I was going to say there hasn't been a whole lot of stuff on my mind that I want to talk about in the podcast, but there has. But for some reason, I just haven't like been in the mood to talk about it in the podcast. Partially because, I don't know, maybe energy levels, partially because like a lot of it is like in the moment stuff, and I tend to like write it down and then kind of forget about it. So unless I go look back at all my notes for like the last 2 weeks, I'm not gonna remember much, and I don't want to spend too much time on it today, because you know, pre-eclipse, watching the eclipse today. But maybe later in the week I might come back and do a longer episode talking about other things I've been jotting down and thinking about. But yeah, generally I've been doing more of my class stuff. Last week I actually had to postpone it because like I've been, and this is a good reminder for myself, but I've been kind of like overworking myself because I have my, you know, of course my full-time job, but then for this class, every week I research, you know, the stuff I want to talk about. Like, I generally know, like, I already prepared my entire, you know, curriculum. But like I said initially, I want to make sure everything I'm talking about is backed up by actual data and, you know, research and citations and all that good stuff. So I'm not just, you know, talking out my ass. So I make sure to do that research week by week to say when I prepare my presentation, I gather all my notes and cross check things and read things and, you know, highlight things and all this, that, and the other. But it can be a lot. It can be a lot of work. And I just haven't had a whole lot of time this past week or two to do that. And then on top of that, I was getting frustrated with both myself and with, you know, just with myself, the world, and with like the lack of information. All right. So this past class was going to be talking about the rise of civilization, of kind of states and stuff like that. But something I realized about myself, which I've been new, but had to come to grips with, is that I don't really care about the rise of civilization. Like, it's kind of, I don't know if this is the wrong use of the word, but it feels ironic, or at least like weird, and that I really enjoy technology, but that point in time where we just started coming up with a whole bunch of different technologies, and the development of civilization, quote unquote civilizations, just does not really excite me. It doesn't really, you know, that's not where my passions lie in terms of learning about history. But I kept forcing myself to do so because I felt obligated to, you know, have to talk about these things and discuss them, because like this is history. But what I had to come to grips with is that there's so much stuff in history. It doesn't mean like I have to talk about it. Like, I can always just be like, hey, you know, you can just research on your own if you're really curious. What I'm personally interested in is those very few but noticeable examples during that same time period of civilizations that maintain their hierarchy. I mean, goodness, whoa, that maintain their egalitarianism, I should say. Goodness. Because what's interesting is that, and concerning really, is that the entire definition, or one of the definitions of quote unquote civilization that many people have been using before, is this assumption of hierarchy, right? It's this assumption that, oh, you know, as people quote unquote developed, right, they created more quote unquote complex societies, which required some which required hierarchy and inequality and stuff like that. And this is where the myth of the quote-unquote social contract comes from. All right, I'm quoting, put all these in scare quotes because it's deeply concerning that we have this assumption that this is what civilization is, right? If we assume that to be civilized, like the very idea of civilized in and of itself is an inherently xenophobic idea, right? It's inherently wrong, right? It's inherently runs on the basis of us and them, of we are here in this place and we're quote-unquote civilized, right? We are better, we are more advanced, we're, you know, more sophisticated, and those other people, they're barbarians, they're brutes, they're, you know, barely even human, right? And I think that we have to seriously recognize the fact that even today, we still use this ideology, right? This idea of, for instance, the first world problems versus third world, right? The idea that you even have these different separate worlds or these different peoples that live in these different places, and one is more advanced than the other, right? Or, quote unquote, more developed than the other. This kind of conception of looking at the world reinforces these very xenophobic and therefore racist and, you know, ethnocentric ideas. So yeah, it was very frustrating to see all that crop up again as I'm researching stuff, because, you know, there's this constant coming across of like, oh, this is the time of civilization, everybody was like awesome, you know. We got so advanced at this time. This is where history starts, basically. And I just find that so disgusting, quite frankly, because as I've been talking about with this whole class and many times in this podcast, the amount of technology advancement and development and things like that that came from before was amazing, right? The fact that, like, stone tools, for instance, it seems simple, but it's extremely difficult to create these sorts of things, right? It's no wonder that it took so long to do so. Okay, I keep getting these messages, and this is, like, distracting me. I might have to mute it 1 second. Sorry, I was just getting like a lot of messages. I was like, is this serious? Like, it's not even about me. But yeah, so it's just very frustrating because as I've delved into history, you see so much amazing and rich interactions and quote real development, as in people learning how to do X, Y, Z, and some really kind of beautiful examples of what humanity can look like. And with the side of hierarchy, don't get me wrong, there's also some cool and beautiful creations, but a lot of it, a huge amount of it, was driven by a stark and like meteoric rise in violence, right? In inequality, in power imbalances. And it's very concerning that we praise this stuff, right? That we put it on a pedestal of human advancement, when in reality, a lot of the, and I think it comes down to like how we conceptualize progress, right? That's something else that I want to do a whole article or something about eventually, but, you know, we view progress as this inherently good thing, as always just going forward and upward or something like that, just categorically or universally getting better. But in reality, very few things do that, right? What we often see is a give and take of, and a lot of it is not even necessarily intentional. Right, that's the other side of it. Like, I really hate this idea of the social contract, because it's like nobody, or at least very few people, actually consciously said, oh yeah, I'm going to live in this city under this government in exchange for my freedom and equality. Like, nobody makes that choice. What actually happened is that you had this shifting, right? And you had this gradual shifting. You had this confluence of influences that were shifting people from one place to another, right? Like I was showing my students, the reason, why did we come up with civilization, even before that, why did we come up with farming, right? Why did the agricultural revolution happen? Like, why did people just start farming a whole lot, and then from there gathering more resources, and then from there building cities, and then from there building states and civilizations and so on and so forth, right? Why? You may think, and some of them said, because maybe people just got smarter at that time, or maybe people just discover a new invention or something. But what you actually see is it was largely due to climate, right? Due to climate change. And it's so funny. I'm laughing because, like, this is something that should be obvious, but because we as humans especially are so arrogant in many ways, right? We don't, like, you never really hear about this in school. Like, and even in college, like when I was researching this, a lot of the research papers and all this other stuff just completely ignore the climate aspect, right? Some of them may mention it a little bit, but the vast majority of them just focus on, like, the scalar problem. Like, that's a whole other thing I wanted to talk about too, is like the language and research papers and academia, and how it's inherently elitist because they use all these vast complicated words and concepts when you don't really need all that. Like, you can explain the same ideas with less complexity, and it still achieves the same result, if not even better, because there's less guessing at what the hell you're talking about, right? But besides that, like, a lot of these papers might mention, the scalar problem, like the when you scale above a certain amount of people, then that requires more complexity, and that usually requires more hierarchy, because the complexity or the difficulty, there's a whole mathematical equation for it, but basically the difficulty for communicating and making decisions at scale, like when you have hundreds or really thousands upon thousands of people trying to live in a certain area and make certain decisions, the costs and time that it takes to make a decision that involves thousands of people eventually becomes unsustainable, to the point where it's more efficient to have a top-down decision-making apparatus, essentially, right? And yeah, use a little bit of big words there, but it's far less than what I've been reading in the research papers. So that's one of the major things they talk about. Another one is, like, the increase in social hierarchy and wealth, right? Like, they like to say, they have more wealth, but what that really means is just that people were able to stockpile resources. They were able to store a whole bunch of potatoes, for instance, just to make it super simple. They have a number of these things, but few of them ever recognize the fact that it was climate that was the precipitating thing for all this. That was the catalyst for all of this, right? And you know this because people have actually been farming for thousands of years prior to that point, right? Prior to the Neolithic Revolution, all right? So what was the difference? The difference was the climate in general got warmer and drier, right, over a span of a couple thousand years. And that basically ended the last major ice age. And that caused that put us into this technically what we're still in now, the interglacial period, right? Technically we're still in a ice age, like globally. The temperatures are not nearly as warm as, like, I think when the dinosaurs and stuff like that. So just a quick little thing here I learned is that we're in an ice age whenever, or the Earth is in an ice age whenever it has ice caps, right? Whenever Antarctica and the North Pole has ice on it, all right? Technically, that's still an ice age. However, within that, that's on the geological scale, meaning millions upon hundreds of millions of years, right? But within those hundreds of millions of years, you have these, they have a complicated word for it, but basically smaller ice ages, right? Smaller glacial and interglacial periods where the glaciers, right, the big pieces of ice, extend, right? Where it's cold enough, like during the actual glacial period, the glaciers from the north extends all the way down to like cover most of America, like half of North America, not just Canada, but like all the way down into where would be the states now, right? Imagine that for a second. If you're in America, imagine the freaking glaciers, for it to be cold enough for glaciers to be all the way down by, you know, past New York, past even like reaching into Colorado and stuff like that. I think it is, like, that's insane. And then on the European side, that means most of Europe is the glaciers, you know. The water levels are lower so that you can actually walk between the UK and the mainland of Europe, right? A lot of China, a lot of these places, right, full of glaciers. And on the south side, it's the same thing, but it's less apparent there because most of it has water at this point. But that does mean like places like Australia is much, much, much cooler, right? I'm not sure if they had glaciers there, but it was way cooler. And the water levels were lower. So again, you can walk from Australia to New Zealand and maybe even places around the Philippines and stuff like that, right? So that's a vastly different world, right? And our ancestors, hundreds of thousands of years ago, began to evolve in that world, right? And usually how this happens is shift, usually the Earth warms up very slowly, right? Over a period of millions of years, to the point where those glaciers, you know, creep back slower and slower every couple thousand, 100,000 years or whatever, right? And that makes it easy, relatively easy, for most animals and most life to evolve and to adapt to those changes, right? But there was a period, they call this the Younger Dryas event. It's not clear exactly how or why it happened. Some theories is that, you know, for some reason, the orbit of the Earth or the angle of the Earth changed. The actual tilt, right, changed. Some even say a meteor impact, but there's very, very little evidence for that anymore, apparently. But the leading, you know, kind of theories is that, which may still be related to the actual tilt thing, is that, you know, a major river broke or it spilled over into one of the major ocean currents and cooled down a lot of the, you know, effects there. Or warmed it up? I don't know, whatever. But basically changed a lot of the ocean currents, and which ended up changing a lot of the other stuff. So instead of, you know, the Earth warming up over hundreds of thousands of years, it started to warm up over a span of just 2,000 to 3,000 years, which sounds like a lot, which is a lot for us, but it's an extremely short amount of time for evolution, right? For animals, for entire species, for entire ecosystems to adapt easily, right? And it's due to that change that enabled both farming to be more efficient, because prior to that time, it was too cold for most things to be planted easily, right? And even within that period of the glacial period, the last ice age, or the period in which the glaciers were much lower down, they had like these intermittent periods where every 100 years, it would suddenly get really cold, even colder, right, to the point where you couldn't grow anything. So even if you started, like, they have this examples of people starting to farm, but then, you know, over like it only lasted a couple of decades, and then boom, it was like a big ice snap, and it was no longer viable. So two things happened during this Younger Dryas event. You have the at least for humans, you have both farming and agriculture became more efficient and more functional, as well as foraging, hunting and gathering actually became less efficient and more difficult, because once again, more animals are not able to adapt as quickly to the environment, right? At that point, humans were very adaptable already. Like, we had already spread across most of the continents, pretty much, yeah, all the continents by that point, right? So there are humans in pretty much every continent already, like we were already prepared for anything, essentially. But these hunter-gatherer cultures who depended on, you know, the animals, right, or the local flora and fauna, they began to see many of these things that they usually, you know, that was usually in abundance, begin to go extinct. Or, like, for instance, like the megafauna, right? There's this idea that humans hunted the megafauna out of existence, but that's not exactly true, right? Yes, humans did hunt megafauna, but it seemed that the bigger cause for why the megafauna went extinct was because of this change in climate. Right, because once again, like, think about mammoths, these big ass creatures, who, you know, wanted to, who needed, you know, all this ice and this colder climate. You know, they were suddenly not really able to live in a warmer, in a climate where it was significantly warmer than where they were before. And by that same token, the many things that they ate, right, were becoming extinct very quickly, or at least becoming less available. And so those megafauna that depended on all this other food, you know, were no longer able to, you know, find that food. And so they went extinct, right? In addition to humans hunting them. So the hunter-gatherer cultures, you know, were able to adapt somewhat, but not very much. Or rather, the way in which many of them adapted was by adapting horticultural, or basically farming, right? Or herding, right? Where they would, you know, begin to take a bunch of bison or cows or other cattle or whatever, and follow them around to, or herd them to specific environments where they knew they would be able to, you know, live more reasonably. So this is how this stuff happened, right? It was not because humans suddenly got smarter, or that we discovered some new technology that made everything possible. We did discover technology along the way, or create some, but a lot of that was driven by climate, right? And that's really important, because if you recognize that our entire society, right, our entire species exists the way that we do today because of climate change, then you would recognize that the climate change that's happening right now is so drastically more, it's so much more drastic that we're going to have to, like, we're going to be adapting far more. Like, it's hard to even imagine, like, to the levels of how much we're going to change. Just, again, think about that for a second, right? All the ideas you have about, like, cavemen and all this other stuff, maybe wrong, it was still relatively, you know, accurate in terms of, like, you had people who didn't really build much structures, not because they couldn't, but because they didn't need to, nor did they really want to, right? Like, why would you build a structure somewhere where you know you're going to move when the seasons change? Like, you know, there's no point. And we know this because we have examples of, once again, people building structures for thousands of years. I think they even dated some of the oldest structures to before the modern human, to 300,000 or 400,000 years ago, right? Again, it maybe wasn't like the biggest pyramid or anything like that, but it was a structure nonetheless, right? So people were building things for a long, long time, but for a long, long time, it was not relevant. It was not efficient. It was not, you know, helpful that much. But when the climate changed, right, it made it harder to do hunting and gathering, and it made farming more efficient. And so, therefore, more people started farming, right? But at the same time, even though that was the more efficient, you know, kind of route for humans, it also caused an extinction in humans, right? We actually see this in the anthropological data where the genetic, diversity, right, the genetic health essentially of humans vastly decreased at this time because there started to be a whole lot more incest and a whole lot more, a whole lot less, I should say, diverse diet, where due to farming, people started eating less of a variety of things, right? So they were not able to get as much nutrients, or at least not a wider amount of nutrients that they usually get or need. And you see this in the data of people's height and their teeth health and their bone health and so on and so forth. So for the first couple thousand years of the Neolithic Revolution, it was terrible to be a human because most people had to do this backbreaking labor, farming and stuff like that. Did not get to eat as much food as they used to, did not get to eat a wider range of food that they used to. It was harder to hunt things if you needed. It was harder to forge things if you needed. And at the same time, as more and more people were farming, they had to find the most fertile land in order to farm successfully, right? But that fertile land is also the best land for grazing or for other animals or for other things that you would usually forage. So the settled cultures, right, the people that started farming more, eventually began to push out the hunter-gatherers to further and further away from the best lands, to the point where this is why you see people like the Khoisan folks or the San in Africa, with the Aborigines in Australia, living in the quote-unquote badlands, right, which some will receive as a wasteland, right, the worst lands to live on, because they were pushed out of all the best lands by farmers. And the reason, if even farmers were even able to do this, right, even though they were by and large weaker and had more disease and had more issues, is because they were able to reproduce faster, right? Again, it comes down to biology, right, where because people were not moving as much, and because I'm basically rehashing my whole class at this point, but I just like talking about this. This is why I'm like doing this in the first place. But anyways, the farmers, they were basically able to. There are a couple things going on here. Number one is that because you were able to hoard resources, right? You can stock resources, right? You can say, okay, I grew a bunch of potatoes, now I have an extra amount of potatoes, you know, for the future. And so that means other people that might not have had a good season, a growing season or something like that, they can use that as a bargaining power to say, okay, can you do this for me if I give you these extra potatoes, right? I see you're struggling over there, you know, here's these extra resources. And therefore you have this feeling of owing the person that granted you this largesse. And that is essentially the kind of the beginnings, or one of the beginnings, I should say, of the hierarchical power imbalance. Another of that is patrilocality versus matrilocality. Not just that strictly, but that was a huge part of it, in which, you know, I think I've talked about this before many times, but basically when, you know, folks got married or like decided to have children, they would usually live with the parent, the mother's parents or the mother's family, right? And that offered the mother more power in a sense, right? More so they can decide when they're going to have children. When they do have children, other people can help take care of the children because everybody saw that as like their kids too, right? That also encouraged the males to basically help the mother more, right? Whereas it's kind of a mutual thing. So all those like evil psych things, where people are like, oh, males are inherently prone to or better at what do you call it? Like I always forget the word. Goodness, polygyny. But basically, where males are like going around and getting impregnating a bunch of women and stuff like that. That's not really a recent thing of human evolution, right? And you can see this in this they call it, I think it's called dimorphic differences. I don't know. But basically the difference between the male and the female, the biological male and female. And most other animals, specifically most other mammals, right, that have this dimorphism. The male is like 200% bigger than the female, right? Because they do have a strategy where the male has a harem, right? Has a whole bunch of women. But that's not a viable strategy for humans. For hundreds of thousands of years, we evolved out of that, right? to the point where it's a more viable strategy to have monogamism, or more accurately, serial monogamism, right? Where you might not be monogamous your entire life, but you regularly like have long-term relationships with different folks, right? And that's for both male and females. And that's because females had more power, right? They had the ability to form groups with other females and push back any, you know, grabby males. So a male can just get their way or just get a whole bunch of females. Yeah, this whole thing, like one of them is called female cosmetic coalition theory. If you look it up, if you want to, if they want to break it down. But basically, the females had the ability to band together and say, no, like, you're not just going to come and do what you want. You got to, if you want, you know, to reproduce, then you're going to have to come and give certain resources or do something or whatever, right? Or join the group, right? And this was actually extremely beneficial for most males because it allowed most males to reproduce. Whereas before, only quote-unquote alpha males would reproduce. And, you know, most species don't really have an actual alpha male, but you do have generally this idea, like one really strong male out reproducing all the others, which is funny because it's not really something wolves do. It's something gorillas or like other apes do and stuff like that. But anyways, humans don't do this, and we haven't done this for almost a million years or 2 million years or something like that. So it's a long ass time for human to adapt other behaviors. And those other behaviors were consent. Those other behaviors were being pro-social. Those other behaviors were, you know, egalitarianism, essentially. But anyways, all that to say, the other mechanism of creating hierarchy was this change in power between males and females, where in patriarchal societies, especially ones that were more, not just farmers, I should say that before, the actual more general term is delayed return peoples. Basically, any place in which you were able to hoard resources, right? So that include herders, that included even fisheries, right? Because you can fish a whole bunch. And what that created was this, again, this ability to stock up on resources. So if anybody is less fortunate, you know, you have this literal power, you have this literal wealth. That's the foundation of wealth, right? Is actual material difference. this created this bargaining power, essentially, this imbalance in bargaining power, to say, okay, instead of the male coming to live with the female's family, that they can essentially buy the female that they wanted and go and live with their family or go and start somewhere else. But that meant the female had less power, had less ability to say no, right? And unfortunately, this is the foundation of the growth and population for cities in general, right? Where you actually see this difference, where in hunter-gatherer cultures and forager cultures, they usually had family planning, right? They would decide when they would have children based on the resources they had available to them, based on how much energy and stuff they can give the child. And so they would usually only have maybe one child every 3 to 4 years, right? So over this period of their lifespan, they might have only had maybe 3, 4, 5 children over their lifespan, right? You know, 3 children every, you know, 3 children per decade or something, or 2 children per decade or something like that, right? 3 to 2. But with farmers, where the woman didn't really have a choice anymore, right? If the man just wanted to have a bunch of kids, and they usually did, because that would help them both with further bargaining power, with being able to, you know, sell off their daughters or stuff like that. But it also helped them with farming, right? Because you can use child labor. You can use the children to help with the farm, and that will get more resources from the farm. You can therefore have your entire family have more riches, right? More material wealth. And on top of that, right, because farming was hard, it became a better strategy not to farm, but to raid other people. And this is where raiding came from. This is where war came from, right? And so now you had this vicious cycle of people who were farming and stuff like that, it would, or not just farming. I'm using farming because that was the vast majority, but it happens as well with fish and with herds. But generally, people who were able to have, you know, gather more resources, were able to, you know, have more children, and then they were able to gather yet more resources, and therefore you have this vicious cycle of growth, a population boom. And this is why you had this huge difference between hunter-gatherer cultures and foraging cultures and stuff like that. It wasn't because farming or settlement cultures, right? It wasn't because foragers were less advanced or were, you know, this idea of like quote unquote barbaric or anything like that. If anything, you know, people who farmed and who eventually built cities were in many ways more barbaric, right? The reason was because they had far more disease, right? They had far more incest and incestual, you know, conditions due to that, right? They had far more issues with many aspects of life. They had far more warfare and violence, right? Both in the house and, you know, between different communities, right? Because that was an aspect of many parts of their society. And so, an interesting thing that you see here too throughout history is that in many times, every time a city or civilization collapses, people will go back to hunting and gathering as far as they could. You know, unfortunately, that became harder and harder as empires grew and they started destroying more parts of the land. That's a whole other aspect you can get into, is that the fact that farming or, you know, and especially building cities always comes with the destruction of land. Just, I've talked about this before as well. But yeah, all that to say, I am extremely interested in the egalitarian cultures and how they were able to establish that. Because apparently there were at least two, maybe three or four cities, even, I hesitate to call them empires, but very wide-scale cities that were very successful egalitarians. One example is Teotihuacan. I'm terrible with that, but it's basically a city in Mexico that was egalitarian, and they knew this because when they were looking at the, you know, the ruins and stuff like that, they noticed that there was no difference between and there's no real difference in house sizes, especially between places that seemed to have more wealth and some that did not, right? You might be able to see a difference in wealth in terms of like pottery, in terms of like designs, like decoration and stuff like that. But the actual size of the house and the quality of those houses did not really differ between what seemed to be the poorest and what seemed to be the wealthiest people, right? There didn't really seem to be a much of a difference there. And this is some of the research that I want to get more into for this upcoming classes. I'm trying to see why, like what that looked like, but it looked like they had a better quality of life than other folks. And then on top of that, what was the other ones? Dang, I forgot the other one. Oh, the Indus River Valley in Pakistan and India. Indus River Valley civilization seemed to be somewhat similar in that they had fairly egalitarian culture, and That one seems to be more obvious because they were earlier. They were one of the earliest civilizations. And typically what you see was with the earlier civilizations is that they were typically had more equality because, again, they were coming right off of the foraging cultures, right? So they value egalitarianism, right? A lot of foraging cultures, as you say before, they weren't just egalitarian by the dint of their lifestyle, right? It was also because they protected that, right? They encouraged that. Yes, their lifestyle made that easier, but many of them had a culture of like doing different things that is reestablished egalitarianism. But as that gets lost throughout the ages, as people have to shift to other cultures, to living in cities or living or farming or doing whatever, they begin to lose that culture. They begin to lose the rituals that they utilize in order to reinforce egalitarianism. It's a number of different things that all comes together to create what we understand as the beginning of civilization, right? And yeah, for me, it was just really frustrating to try and focus only on like, oh, the positives of civilization. I'm like, oh yeah, it was this great time where we did all these cool things and built all these cool structures. I'm like, there's a whole lot of stuff that's not so good. And that's what I wanted to focus on. Not because I want to be a pessimist or whatever, but to understand why, right? To understand what we lost and to try and figure out how can we change today? Like, what can we do today to have rituals or cultures or things, or even change our lifestyle to influence or to bias towards egalitarianism? Like, what can we do? Like, can we create some sort of immediate return societies in our current lifestyle to make it very hard, if not impossible, to hoard resources? Maybe not, but maybe so. Like, maybe, you know, sell cultures instead of trying to create 3D printed meats and foods in a lab in a centralized location in a factory or something like that. Maybe we create ones that are less efficient at scale, but perfect for very small scale stuff, or for just, you know, taking some resources in your home and putting in a printer and boom, you print out some food, right? But it only works on a small scale. Like, you literally can't scale it up, right? It'd be unsustainable if you scale it up. But if you, there are many types of inventions that work where they do not work at scale. And so instead of us focusing on, oh, how can we scale? How can we scale? How can we scale? Let's think about, like, maybe scale in and of itself is not always a good thing, right? Maybe sometimes we should not scale, right? Maybe we can create technologies that don't scale and therefore grant more power to more people, right? Because there's less of a difference in bargaining power. There's less of a difference in who has access to what technology, right? These are the types of things that excite me about this, about learning about history, and I hope to bring forward toward the future. So yeah, that's a lot of things I've been learning and thinking about. Other stuff I've been doing is just playing games. I've been playing this game called Risk of Rain 2, another game called Lightyear Frontier, but I've been talking for a while, so I might pick that up later. I did not expect to go into the whole thing about this, but this is why I enjoy talking about this stuff, man. It just I don't know, excites me, and I just start going off about it. So I'm super fortunate and glad that I'm able to teach this sort of thing. And I'm looking forward to doing more research and learning more, and all the while, like, as I'm learning this, I'm thinking about, like, how can I, you know, funnel it into the thing I want to do in terms of building better futures, right? I think I talked about that before, but I want to rehash it again. But yeah, I'll stop there because my throat was dry and I want to prepare for the eclipses. Yeah, eclipses is just a brief aside. It's just interesting that we get excited about eclipses. Like, I wasn't even like that excited about it before, but as other people are excited about it, it's like, I don't know, reinvigorating me. It's not like I don't think they're cool. It's just like, you know, it's an interesting little event. But I find it invigorating how other people are excited about it. And I just like when humans are excited, you know. It's a fun thing. It's a cool thing to see. It's I don't know. I guess it speaks to our humility, right? Like, I don't like when humans are arrogant. It sucks. Cause, like, yeah, we're cool. We're awesome folks, you know. But there's a lot of other things better and bigger than us, right? And I think oftentimes we can get to a point where we feel like we know everything, where we feel like we're above everything, we're so great, you know, stuff like that. Even people who hate humans, even misanthropic people who be like, oh, humans are terrible. It's that's a kind of arrogance, right? Because it's not that humans are terrible and we destroy everything. That's arrogant. It's that we are just one part of a larger system, right? And yes, we can do a lot of damage, but we can also do a lot of good, right? And at the same, we can also do a whole lot of nothing in the geological span of time in a million years. But there may not even be any evidence that we existed. Like, I don't know. A bit of existentialism for your day. But, you know, when the sun explodes, you know, we're gone. Like, So I just think sometimes it's good to remember that, yes, we're cool, we can do awesome stuff, but we're also just one of many, you know. We're part of everything. We're part of this all. So yeah, it's just cool to see when people are excited about stuff, 'cause then it speaks to inherent humility and inherent awe of the world, and I think that's really cool. So yeah, even though I'm just saying, talking now, but yeah. As always, thanks for listening, thanks for watching. Have fun with the eclipse, have fun learning and loving and growing, and as always, don't be afraid to be radical, don't be afraid to be revolutionary, keep being awesome, love yourself, love others, and have a great day. See you, bye-bye.